You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Although I was going to say we're back together. Were we together last week? I can't remember.
No, we weren't, were we? We were on our slightly curtailed first leg of the Cycling Podcast Grand Tour of Parts of Britain.
Did you get knocked out? Did you lose in the first round?
No, we had a very successful evening in Salford at the Lowry Theatre. Myself and Richard and Francois Thomazeau came over from Marseille, beat the snow, Orla Chenoui as well. Really buzzing, weren't we, Rich, after that first night? And then, unfortunately, Scotland was closed for business, so we were unable to get to Edinburgh and Glasgow. So those dates have been, or are in the process of being, rearranged. We'll be at the Signet Library in Edinburgh now on April the 12th, and if you have a ticket, that will be valid. Glasgow, we're still waiting for confirmation of the venue for that now, aren't we? And we will announce that as soon as we possibly can. But we're definitely going back. And we resume with you, Daniel. Yeah, tomorrow night, Wednesday night in Nottingham at the Arts Theatre. Still tickets available. Do come along. Anyone in a reasonable radius of Nottingham. And then Hackney on Thursday.
And Super Sub.
And then Leeds
Super
on Friday and Sheffield on Saturday. But the question is, will we have anything to talk about? Is there anything... anything happening at the moment in cycling?
This is going to be a short one, isn't it? Because not really very much has happened in the world of cycling this week.
Indeed. shall we just blast on? Sorry, Daniel, were you going to say something there?
No.
Nothing at all?
I was keeping my own counsel.
Okay. Well, before we get on to talking about all the events in cycling over the last week, Lionel, give us a quick refresher, news roundup, please.
Well, I'll review the racing. We're going to talk about Strada Bianchi in the first part of this podcast. A fantastic race. I'll just run through the basics. Lotto Soudal's Thijs Benoot won. It was his first victory as a professional. Really impressive, going clear with around 12 kilometres to go. Before that, Romain Bardet and the cyclocross world champion Wout van Aert had been away together. Amazing race. We'll talk about that in quite some depth, I think, in the first part. If anyone didn't see the film or the footage that was knocking around on Twitter of Wout van Aert cramping up on the sort of steep run in into Siena, look that clip up, because it just shows, you know, what can happen when both of a bike rider's legs lock up at the same time. The women's race was won by Anna van der Breggen ahead of Katarina Nieuwendomme and Eliza Longo Borghini. Paris-Nice is underway. Stage one was a photo finish between Arnaud Démare, the French champion. He got the verdict just ahead of Gorka Izaguirre of Bahrain-Merida. Another couple of riders also very close. It took a while to sort that one out with the aid of the photo finish. No such doubt about stage two. Dylan Groenewegen won yet again. A real flying start to the season for... what do you call him, Daniel? What's his nickname?
The Atomic Tadpole.
The Atomic Tadpole. Brilliant.
There's a reason why I think it's not catching on just yet. I think people think he's taller than he is. He's actually quite a diminutive fellow when you stand close to him.
Yeah, that's
He's literally the size of a tadpole.
Definitely why it's not catching on. Anyway, Paris-Nice is ongoing, so that finishes at the weekend. Tirreno Adriatico will be underway before we know it, and the outdoor cycling is really picking up now. But of course, the indoor cycling reached the zenith of the season with the World Championships in Apeldoorn. A lot going on there, and we're not really going to get a chance to talk too much about it, I don't think, in this episode because of other things going on. But a few things that caught the eye there. Great Britain won the Team Pursuit World title for the fifth time. Ed Clancy was leading a young quartet to the gold medal there. He was lining up with the former sprinter Kian Imadi and a couple of young lads, 19-year-old Ethan Hayter and 21-year-old Charlie Tanfield. I mean, they're adults, obviously, but you know, from my perspective, they're young lads. Anyway, they beat Denmark in the final. In the individual pursuit, and another impressive performance by the Italian Filippo Ganna on the track. Richard made the point that he was riding at Kerner Brussels Kerner a week ago. He's now got a gold medal in the individual pursuit. The Dutch beat Great Britain in the team sprint. Young Jack Carlin, 20, another of Great Britain's young riders that are coming to prominence now. He was in that team and he added another silver medal in the individual sprint, losing to Matthew Glaitzer of Australia in the final. Another gold for Cameron Meyer in the points race for Australia. Remember, he kind of retired and then came back and he's now on top of the world again. In the women's events, well, Kirsten Wild of the Netherlands dominated the endurance event. Certainly she won the scratch race, the points race and the Omnium, and she was second with Amy Peters in the Madison. They were beaten by the Great Britain pair Katie Archibald and Emily Nelson. Wild dominated the endurance events, and it was the Germans who dominated the sprints. Christina Vogel won the sprint, Miriam Welter took the 500 metres, and the two of them joined forces to win the team sprint. But arguably, and I think Richard will make the case for this, arguably the outstanding performance of the week was by America's Chloe Dygert. The 21-year-old broke Sarah Hammer's 8-year-old women's individual pursuit world record in qualifying and then broke that again in the final when she caught Annemiek van Vleuten. The record for the pursuit, the women's pursuit, is now 3:20.06. Dygert was also in the US quartet that beat Great Britain in the final of the team pursuit. And watching a bit of the track over the weekend reminded me of the World Championships when they were last held in Apeldoorn 2011, and that, you know, everyone was kind of just building themselves back up for the London Olympics the following year, and it felt quite sort of a flat edition of the World Championships at that time. But my mind was also taken back a decade to Manchester this week, because that was when Bradley Wiggins really, well, he dominated the velodrome through the sort of force of his personality that week, really. He won the individual pursuit. I think, did they win the team pursuit as well? I'm pretty sure they did, didn't they, Richard? And won the Madison with Mark Cavendish with that extraordinary performance in that race. One of the sort of, probably, arguably one of the best races that Manchester track has ever witnessed. And of course, here we are 10 years on. The big story of the week is the publication of the Digital Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee report into doping in sport, or more particularly at this point, doping in athletics and cycling. And the parliamentary verdict on, well, British Cycling and Team Sky, which we will talk about, I suspect, in length in the final part of this podcast. So I'll leave that there for now.
Yeah, indeed. I just need Rob Hatch, really, but he's a bit Paris. Need some pronunciation police intervention here, Lionel. Elisa Longo Borghini, surely, third in Strada Bianchi.
Was it? Yeah, not winning Paris Nice, though, was it? So double correction there.
And I'm disappointed you didn't mention probably the best ever World Track Championships for Scotland with Katie Archibald, Mark Stewart, a bronze medal in the points race, and young Jack Carlin as well. So that's surely worthy of mention.
Stick a kilt on it, eh, Richard?
But we will get on to Strada Bianchi in a moment. But yeah, as you said, I wanted to highlight, well, Chloe Dygert in particular, but Filippo Ganna as well. Both very young, both 21 actually. Great prospects, especially Chloe Dygert, I think. I mean, Ganna's a huge guy. I saw him at Kerner Buses Kearney Road, Het Nieuwsblad as well, though he didn't finish either. His bike towers over everybody else. He's got very long levers. But he and Dygert, very, very promising riders, and Dygert beat Annemiek van Vleuten in the finals. So, yeah, I think those were the two outstanding performances from the World Track Championships. But it was a great weekend of racing with Strada Bianchi as well, and Tesh Benoot coming of age at last. He's still a young guy. What is he, 23 still? But he's his first professional win, and I think ever since he finished fifth at Tour of Flanders in his first year as a pro, we've expected great things from him. It was very interesting listening back to an interview you did with him and an interview you did, Lionel, with Marc Sergent, his boss at Lotto-Soudal, just about his shortcomings as a rider, which Sergent said he's always had a problem with winning, you know, right through the, as a junior, as an under 23, he has a problem with winning. He doesn't have a sprint. He needs, as we saw on Saturday, I think, a race to be really, really, really hard, a war of attrition. And he's a sort of old school bike racer, isn't he? He looks like a rider from the 50s, his position on the bike. He's got this long back. And I don't know, he's a kind of throwback in that sense. And I think his problem is going to be that he needs the race to be so, so hard that he's probably going to win very few, but those that he does win will be very memorable.
Well, I think they all look like throwbacks to the 50s on the weekend, because the weather was bad. The snow cleared up, but it was rainy and cold. And, of course, the dust roads turned to muck and everyone was coated in a sort of a thin layer of white. They looked quite ghostly, a lot of the riders, by the time the TV coverage came on. And clearly, it was a tough race. Only 180-ish kilometres, but an absolute bona fide classic race. You know, the course always makes it attractive to watch, but the conditions this weekend, you know, edged it up a notch in terms of, you know, difficulty and in terms of how watchable it was, really.
And just to see, you know, Benoit, Romain Bardet and Wout van Aert being the three guys at the front, such different riders, difficult to imagine any other race where those three would emerge at the head of the race. You know, a Tour de France contender, a world cyclocross champion, and a sort of classics rider slash, you know, all-rounder. That was great to watch as well, because it just threw up you know, a bit like Milan San Remo, where you can see riders with very different strengths and skill sets joining forces.
Yeah, it's a funny old race, Strade Bianche, isn't it? I think we talked about last year the fact that there aren't, I don't think, clearly embedded, well, partly because the course changes every year, but clearly embedded in people's head and people sort of understanding of bike racing, exactly where guys are going to be able to make the difference, exactly what are the strategic, going to be the key strategic points, exactly what sort of rider is going to thrive there. It was a nice snapshot of the cross section we get now in professional cycling. Is the winner, you got Benoit, whose brother's a ballet dancer, but at the same time, you know, looked like a rider who'd been, as you said, plucked right out of the 1950s, hunched over his handlebars in a jersey that's a dead ringer for Eddie Merckx's old Faema jersey. Then second place, you had Bardet, who, judging by his Instagram account, had spent the week quaffing Brunello and guzzling black truffles in Tuscany. And then third, you had a cyclocross rider who couldn't even get up the hill on his bike. He had to walk up the last
a little bit harsh.
I mean, we didn't mention last week, but Van Aert, he rode well in Het Nieuwsblad as well. And to go from, you know, hour-long races to that strikes me as pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, his cyclocross skills came into handy. The last time we saw him, before Het Nieuwsblad, the last time we saw him was pushing his bike through the thick mud of Valkenburg a few weeks ago. And it wasn't a textbook dismount, was it, on the run into Siena. I think he'll be a little disappointed with that when he sees it back, which he's obviously seen it back now, but hasn't he? So I'm imagining he is disappointed. He kind of slumped off his bike rather than the more graceful dismount. You're absolutely right, Rich, that the race, seeing Bardet particularly take it on, and you mentioned when we spoke yesterday that a year ago Bardet was getting disqualified from Paris-Nice for holding onto a car, wasn't he? So quite a change in fortunes this year compared to the way he started last season. And to see him compete in a race, I mean, if you had to say, take the conditions and the course, and if you ask me which races would least suit a rider of Romain Bardet's physique as much as anything else, I probably would have said that, Strade Bianche, because when I heard he's up the road before I watched, because I recorded it and watched it later, but I did see on Twitter that he was up the road, I was kind of sort of shaking my head slightly, wondering what he was playing at.
And on Bardet, Lionel, it's just struck me in the first few weeks of the season, I mean, it's very, very early, but he's already won one race. He's finished second in Strade Bianche. It's already shaping up in a similar way to, I know we're going to talk about Wiggins later and we're going to discuss, you know, the merits and the rights and wrongs of his 2012 season. But, you know, he had that season, which was a real sort of annus mirabilis, where he won absolutely everything, where the stars just aligned straight away. Chris Froome's had that kind of season. And, you know, if we think about what might happen with Chris Froome and the fact that he might not even be in the Tour de France, things that the sort of path is clearing quite nicely for Romain Bardet. And it wouldn't shock me terribly if he was to line up at the start of the Tour de France as the favourite. It seems like quite an improbable prospect now, but as I say, things are shaping up pretty well for him, I would suggest.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to our long-term sponsors, Rafa. We went to the Rafa Cafe in Manchester last week to sell advanced copies of our book. Thanks to everybody who came along and said hello before our show in Salford. And a reminder that all our Rafa clothing is on their site. You can get to it from thecyclingpodcast.com. Click on shop. And the Pedaleurs de Charme t-shirts are in stock now as well to go alongside the Pedaleur de Charme kit. Jersey's coming as well, so keep an eye out for that. Thank you very much to Rafa for their support. Any more racing to discuss, chaps, before we turn our attention to the latest Sky news? Paris-Nice is going on, of course. Tirreno Adriatico begins, we're speaking on the eve of Tirreno Adriatico. Paris-Nice has started well. Arnaud Démare won an excellent first stage, a kind of four-up sprint, bit of a photo finish. He won that, and as we speak, he is leading the race overall. Tirreno Adriatico is the other race, perhaps more of the GC kind of guys there, the Grand Tour contenders there. Among them, Chris Froome, who remarkably, his start at Tirreno Adriatico is not the biggest story concerning Team Sky this week. His salbutamol case still unresolved, of course, and with very little news on that recently. So it's as you were, and Chris Froome starts Tirreno Adriatico. Anything else from the racing before we get on to Sky?
One thing, Rich, I was going to say about Strade Bianche, going back to Thijs Benoot, it did strike me watching him win at the weekend and thinking about how his career's gone so far. We talked about his 2015 and how he burst onto the scene with a fifth place in the Tour of Flanders when he was, I think, 21. And still a student. In fact, he's still a student. I think he's got two exams.
Economics.
Still to do. It sort of seemed to me that he perhaps didn't continue in quite the same vein over the next two seasons, 2016, 2017. But I had a look at his results. He was in the top 10 16 times in 2016, 21 times in 2017. But I think the question mark for him and for a lot of fans, and particularly Belgian fans, was and where his speciality lay, really, because he also had some very good results in stage races. I think he was eighth in a mountain stage of the Dauphiné in 2015, 20th 16, in the Tour de France. In 2015.
Oh,
I checked, Richard. Wow. Sometimes I do some research.
Sorry.
And 20th in the Tour de France last year. And, I don't think necessarily what happened at the weekend is going to bring a lot of clarity as to where his priorities are going to lie in the future. But I was curious and interested to hear him say after Saturday that he's not going to do Milan-San Remo or Paris-Roubaix. And, you know, what you said, Marc Sargeant, talking about the problem he had with winning and, you know, the lack of a fast finish, that perhaps explains why he's not going to target Milan-San Remo in particular. But it had struck me that he's one of those guys in the peloton at the moment that don't fit the classic profile of a classics rider, but who could potentially win most of the monuments, if not all of them.
I remember Maxime Montfort as well just sort of rolled his eyes and said, this guy can do everything. You know, he was 22 at the time, and that can be a curse as well. You know, he's very versatile, he's very consistent, he can do everything. So what should he try and do really well? He's also one of these very impressively self-assured guys, you know, from a very young age. I did that interview with him a couple of years ago, and then since then, I've often tried to speak to him at races and got a bit of a cold shoulder. I think he's very in the zone at races and, very serious about what he does. It's funny, though, isn't it? He's a sort of somehow typical Lotto Soudal rider, like Tim Wellens. You know, it's funny how riders emerge in teams that appear to be perfectly suited to them. It's a sort of chicken and egg scenario, I suppose. But he does strike me as a very Lotto Soudal rider. I don't know why, but anyway, he's a great talent, and I think when it gets really hard like that, we're going to see him win other hashtag epic races.
Or hashtag epic ban there, Richard. We got so far through talking about Strade Bianche without saying the word epic. I thought we'd done well there.
Sorry about that.
Straight in the sin bin for that.
It's been an epic week for Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins and everything else, isn't it? Where do we start? Where do we start with this? I mean, this report from the DCMS, long awaited. Their inquiry has been going on for a long, long time. It was published at midnight, or at 1 minute past midnight on Monday morning. In terms of bombshells, no bombshells perhaps, but the line that Team Sky crossed an ethical line, if not a legal line, is one that's been said before. I think we've all said it in over the last 18 months or so in discussing Bradley Wiggins' TUEs, but it has the weight of a parliamentary committee behind it, and it's published on a paper produced by a select committee of the Houses of Parliament. So it carries real weight and authority, and we've seen in the headlines and the coverage of the case, you know, that claim, that allegation coming from a group of MPs is more than newsworthy. It has plunged Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins into a real crisis, perhaps the biggest one yet.
Yeah, I think maybe if we just run through just a few of the lines that jumped out because they were new to us, I guess. First of all, Shane Sutton explicitly saying that what Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins did in applying for TUEs to use triamcinolone was unethical. That's not, no one within the organisation had gone as far as that before. There were also allegations of systematic use of cortisone in training, particularly among the riders or a group of riders who were preparing for the 2012 Tour de France, and those riders aren't named. Of course, using cortisone in training and therefore out of competition, you know, that isn't an anti-doping rule violation. So again, it's possibly unethical, but not against the rules. There's a claim that Shane Sutton bullied Dr. Richard Freeman, who was the doctor with at various times working with both Team Sky and British Cycling. They were the main sort of new lines that came out of the report. And I suppose if you had to summarise the tone of the report, it is that the evidence given by Dave Brailsford and others, really, it wasn't really believed, was it? The tone is that the Parliamentary Select Committee are upholding the allegations, not the explanations. And I think that is what has brought Bradley Wiggins out quite on the offensive, I suppose. Obviously, we've not really heard a great deal from him since the Fancy Bears hack in September 2016. But Bradley Wiggins spoke to the BBC's Dan Rowan, and I mean, the transcript of that interview is on the BBC's website and is certainly worth a read. And I think whatever people think of the way that this has played out, I think that the one conclusion that some people are already drawing is that, you know, Bradley Wiggins perhaps didn't really have the greatest opportunity to contribute to shaping the direction the investigation went in. It seems, I still haven't really got to the bottom of why Bradley Wiggins has not been one of the chief witnesses in this entire investigation, seeing as so much of it centres on medication that was given to him and his medical conditions.
You mentioned it there, Lionel, but another square that hasn't been circled is Shane Sutton comes out with the line that what they were doing was unethical. When he sat before the Select Committee, he claimed not to know about the treatment that Bradley Wiggins was getting. So that contradicts that, perhaps, saying that he knew at the time it was unethical, but also that claim that he bullied Richard Freeman. So if Team Sky were doing something that Sutton believed to be unethical, the doctor would presumably be very, very involved in that, the doctor who the report alleges was being bullied by Shane Sutton. So there's more to come on that particular story, I think.
Yeah, and I think we should just as well, point out Bradley Wiggins very strong in saying that he felt that the triamcinolone was given to him for a medical condition, a medical need, and that is his asthma, which he suffered from for a number of years. I think, again, a lot of this has been centred on, how open Wiggins has been about suffering from asthma in the past, and, you can disappear down sort of rabbit holes trying to unpick all of the detail of this. But from Wiggins' point of view, he states that the triamcinolone was for a medical need, whereas the report very strongly draws you to the conclusion that they don't, that the DCMS Select Committee don't accept that. And in, if that is the case, and bearing in mind the report's written with the benefit of parliamentary privilege, really what they're saying is that Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins did in fact break the wider code by applying for a TUE which did not have a medical need. Then of course the flip side of that, so it's sort of, it's not two sides to this story, it's a kind of hexagonal shaped story really, because Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins could then go back and say, well, we were granted the TUE in accordance with the rules as they were at the time by the UCI, and you know, with third party medical authority to grant that TUE. So it really isn't a case of black and white, it's a case of back and forth. And I don't know, having read the sort of 50 odd pages of the report and having read the section that refers to cycling more than once and some parts of it more than twice, I'm still not an awful lot clearer as to what the next step in all of this is, because still in a report that is in place, very detailed and in place rather patchy, there isn't actually an anti-doping rule violation uncovered, and you can't see how anyone could put this forward as evidence to say, let's open an anti-doping rule violation case against Bradley Wiggins. So you know, exactly where are we? I'm not entirely sure.
Well, there are two possible anti-doping violations, Lionel, that we could hypothesise. One regards the use of triamcinolone, the famed Jiffy bag story. The allegation was republished, reported in the parliamentary report that this mystery Jiffy bag contained triamcinolone, and Bradley Wiggins took it that evening after the 2011 Dauphiné, when in theory he was still in competition. And we've talked a lot about the difference between ethics and legality. You know, ethics are woolly, they're subjective, they vary from person to person. Legality is not. However, if he did do that, strictly speaking, that is, if he took the triamcinolone that evening, that is an anti-doping rule violation. I would suggest that if that had been the case, he might be able to get off on a what WADA call what was it, negligence. In that case, if it's a kind of administrative error or not really understanding the rules, we've seen precedents before where people have, you know, they've got 3 month bans and a sort of slap on the wrist. I don't think it's gonna come to that. I don't think a case is gonna be brought on the strength of the evidence we've got at the moment. The other issue is this one of possibly faking a medical need for the TUE for the triamcinolone. Now, in the WADA code, in the WADA regulations, I can't see it laid out any proviso for what happens in those cases. If an athlete or their team exaggerates or misreports symptoms, which therefore lead to a TUE being granted when it shouldn't be. As I say, I don't see any proviso for that in the paragraphs on anti-doping rule violations and what constitutes one. And I don't know of any precedents where someone has been punished for precisely that offence.
It's interesting that the parliamentary report stops short of accusing Bradley Wiggins of an anti-doping rule violation, because they could have said that they believed there had been one. Just to read out that line, they say, "We believe that drugs were being used by Team Sky within the WADA rules to enhance the performance of riders and not just to treat medical need." That sentence to me seems a little bit contradictory, because the WADA rules are, you know, the TUE system is designed to address medical need, not to enhance performance. So I think that's a little bit confused. And if they had felt that there was an anti-doping rule violation, presumably they could have said it.
Well, they could have done under the parliamentary privilege that the report is covered by. And that's back to the point. I completely accept both your points there, Daniel. And one of the things we talked about at length when this whole story broke, and the revelation of the Jiffy bag being couriered to France on the last day of the 2011 Dauphiné, that story was broken. I believe that was Matt Lawton's story in the Daily Mail, wasn't it? And then the contents of the Jiffy bag not being you know, confirmed one way or the other. Dave Brailsford said that he was told it was Flumacil, which is a kind of over-the-counter or, you know, easily not prescribed decongestant. So that's not a, you know, there's no issue with that. But we talked about this at length, that the hypothesis that Wiggins have been given triamcinolone after the final stage of the 2011 Dauphiné, which counts as in competition, even though the race has finished for the day. The rules are that up until midnight, it's in competition. But that case has not been proved. And there's nothing in that report that kind of kicks the door down to say, well, we have enough evidence to say that that is what happened. And of course, now we have Wiggins saying, well, that's definitely not what happened. And so what we have really is a situation that is no clearer really from an anti-doping rule violation point of view than it was before the report was published. But what we do have is the kind of, the undoubted damage to Team Sky's reputation, to Bradley Wiggins' reputation, and of course the way that the story has been covered over the last sort of 36 hours, understandably so. The conclusion that people are being drawn to is Bradley Wiggins used drugs to improve his performance, and that is the way the story has been framed, and really nobody involved in it is able to contradict that or really say, well, no, that's definitely not the case, because there's still, depending on which experts are speaking, there's still a conflict of opinion about whether or not, you know, there's a significant performance enhancing benefit to using triamcinolone. So it's not a clear case. But if I had to say, well, you know, go back to what I said when the whole thing blew up, Team Sky, they operated far, far too close to the line. They may not have technically crossed it. And we can argue about that. If this had been known in 2011, 2012, when Bradley Wiggins, particularly 2012, when Bradley Wiggins was in the yellow jersey, and if it had come out and said, well, he's using cortisone or he has used cortisone on the eve of the Tour de France, I don't think he would have made Paris. The way these stories played out at that time and still would today, I think that, you know, it was hugely important for them that this issue did not make it into the public domain for very obvious reasons.
What we have here really is a moral judgment, isn't it? That's what the report is, in essence, a moral judgment on the team and their ethics. And that's kind of odd. And it's been strange to hear and see how it's played out in the mainstream media, because, you know, if you listen to the Radio 4, for example, it was the lead item on the Today programme, which is listened to by about 8 million people. And all the people who came, the experts who came on the programme to discuss it, were all pretty critical of Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins. They included Damien Collins, Michel Verrocchio, and Tony Doyle as well. And it was an odd one where the presenter of the programme was in the position of almost defending Bradley Wiggins and Team Sky. Not defending them, but putting the other point of view, which was that they didn't break any rules. It was a very strange thing to hear played out. And I think probably left an awful lot of lay people completely confused about it. I've had a few messages from, you know, friends who don't really follow cycling just asking me in one line, so what should I think of Bradley Wiggins now? And, you know, it's more than a one-line response. It's so complicated. And unfortunately, people want and need doping cases to be black and white. And this one's not.
And this, Rich, unfortunately, is why teams need a strong ethical position, and they need to stick by a strong ethical position. I mean, as far as we're concerned, and we've spoken about it a lot in the recent months, legality is the only thing that matters as far as the sport is concerned, and the future of the sport, and, you know, obviously whether riders are banned, whether they're not. However, if you're starting a team which is designed to appeal to and resonate with the lay public and bring new people into the sport, the new viewer or the uninitiated viewer does not have time to go through the WADA code like I've done over the last 24 hours and like we've done over the last few months and really pick apart what are the legalities of this case. And they need things in terms that they can understand, and they can understand ethics. I mean, everyone's ethics are different, and that's one of the problems with ethics. But, you know, everyone has very clear in their own mind what is right and what is wrong. Unfortunately, that is why it is important, as I say, to do things which respect an ethical code, which is clearly, transparently laid out in advance. And, you know, as we know, as we've spoken about with Team Sky, they set out one ethical code and they painted it in very clear terms when the team launched. And it seems as though They have not respected that ethical code.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to our sponsor, Science in Sport. You can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceandsport.com by entering the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. And that offer is available to anybody in the UK and not in conjunction with other offers. A reminder, we are collecting your questions for the Science and Sport experts. We've had a few crackers. Thank you very much for them. We'll be putting to them soon. Email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com with any sports nutrition questions. And thank you once again to Science and Sport. I always remember at the end of the Tour of Britain in 2010, a conversation. I was standing by the Team Sky bus and quite an elderly lady came and spoke to Dave Brailsford. I was standing nearby and listened into that conversation. And she thanked him for leading British cycling to all its Olympic successes and then said, more or less, I'm paraphrasing, we don't care whether this team wins or not. We just want it to believe in it. And Brailsford sort of reassured her and said she had nothing to worry about. But there was always the sense, and we've spoken about this a lot, that the ambition to win led to some compromises of that initial line that was taken with the team about being not just equal to, but better than other teams in terms of probity and cleanliness, I suppose. The question is, it's kind of strange to judge a team by the standard that it's set for itself. If a team comes along with no statements on anti-doping or anything, do they just get a free pass? I mean, this is the slightly absurd nature of it.
Well, it comes down, Rich, to what I said about resonating with the public. I mean, what is your goal as a team? I mean, I personally don't have any particular problem with Sky having a set of ethics which is different from the from other people's ethics. As long as they respect the rules, that's fine as far as I'm concerned. However, they're trying to resonate with the general public. That was one of their very clear goals mm-hmm. when they came into professional cycling, and they wanted to bring people in. So you have to hold up a mirror and you have to look at what those people are expecting ethically. And I think, once you've laid out what those ethics are and the fact that those ethics are going to be more or less what people expect of you, then you have to respect them.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, if you bank the PR capital by saying, making very, very strong statements, then you quietly shelving those statements a little bit later, it doesn't sit awfully well with most people, because people will take and did take Team Sky at their word, really. And I don't think anyone, this is, we talk about the lay people. When you're trying to market your team and Bradley Wiggins winning the Tour de France to a large number of people, there isn't kind of room, is there, on the flyer to put all the caveats in brackets. We will observe the wider code, brackets, but we may well use certain substances out of competition when permitted, brackets. Do you know what I mean? This is the problem,
Lionel. Yeah, people don't have time for this. People can't digest all this. We have the luxury of spending a whole day thinking about this and reading regulations and so forth, but the general public does not have the time for this.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's very difficult to look back over the whole life of the team and separate one event from another, or one statement from another. It's a whole kind of everything is kind of interconnected, and events that happened that maybe didn't seem very significant at the time suddenly gained more significance. I think that generally the thing that's really kind of settled in my mind over the last sort of 24 hours or so is that the Lance Armstrong case was the one that kind of changed everything. It kind of, the dam burst at that point, didn't it? Because suddenly everyone was becoming much more aware of what had gone on in that era. People who were associated with Lance Armstrong's team were having their past sort of dug into and looked at. I mean, that happened at the end of 2012, didn't it? Just months after Bradley Wiggins mm-hmm. won the Tour de France. And I mean, I don't want to pick on Sean Yates. I don't want to use him just as an example and single him out, because I think that during his time at Team Sky, he wasn't hired by Team Sky, I don't think, to sort of run some clandestine doping program. I mean, he may well have had some first-hand knowledge of some fairly nefarious practices. I mean, You know, you only have to go back and look at the sort of cuttings file of Cycling Weekly, and you can see that he failed a dope test in 1989 at the Tour of Belgium. You know, that dope test was then, it kind of went away. You know, there was no sanction taken. So, you know, the circumstances of that are sort of not lost in the mists of time, but, you know, there's no clear definitive account of what went on there. But then, you know, if you're talking about Dave Brailsford sort of opening statement about Team Sky and the fact that he wouldn't hire anyone who'd had an association with doping, you know, Sean Yates had ridden for Motorola with Lance Armstrong, had been a sports director at Discovery Channel with Johan Bruneel and Lance Armstrong, had been a sports director at Bjarne Riis, who had taken EPO and had confessed to taking EPO to win the Tour de France. He'd been a sports director at Astana when Alexander Vinokourov came back from his ban. So, you know, my quibble always with Brailsford was what constitutes an association with doping. And it was clear right from the first day. It was a statement designed to appeal to executives at Sky and the broader general public. It wasn't really one to be looked at placed under the microscope, because clearly it couldn't stand up to scrutiny. But what I was going to say, Rich, was, sorry, that the rules of the game change, don't they? Because in July 2012, when Sean Yates was in the team car for Team Sky, as Bradley Wiggins wins the Tour de France, he was in the GB team car, I believe, behind Bradley Wiggins when he won the time trial, the Olympic time trial, a week later. You know, there was no kind of, hang on a minute, Sean Yates, what's all this about? Scroll forward 3 years after Lance Armstrong's downfall. Suddenly, a big national newspaper story is the fact that a Belgian soigneur who no one had ever heard of, called Peter Verbeeken, who'd worked briefly for US Postal, maybe for a couple of years at US Postal, was working for Team Sky, effectively stacking water bottles and tyres in the Team Sky service course, their warehouse in Belgium. And suddenly, you know, that was a story that gained quite a lot of traction at that time, 2015, whereas 3 years earlier, someone who I would say would have had a knowledge of what went on in the sport in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, an intimate knowledge perhaps, you know, that story didn't really get on the radar at all and so wasn't brought to the attention of the broader public. And so the landscape changes, as well as the way we have to look at these stories changes as time goes on as well.
Napalm, I was only trying to interrupt you to plug your excellent blog because you've written about an early exchange with Dave Brailsford in 2009 when he was setting up the team. It's a fascinating little insight into his mindset at the time. What comes across is his lack of preparedness for these questions, his naivety and idealism, I suppose, as well, come across very strongly there. And I think we've all known Dave Brailsford for a long time. And I guess when he comes along and makes these, you know, pronouncements about winning the Tour clean with a British rider in 5 years and so on, which they did, well, they did do, asterisk, we always kind of took them with a bit of a pinch of salt, you know. And I think there's a danger here where the whole thing, where we're expected, again, it's about seeing things in black and white and dividing the world up into, you know, good and evil. And life and people are far more complex than that. Team Sky and British Cycling did do a lot of things extremely well, and they did bring innovation into the sport, no question of that at all. At the same time, and not inconsistent with that, other elements of the organisation were clearly shambolic, as I think is the case in pretty much any organisation run by humans. But you know, the medical record keeping, which it could be the thing that comes back to haunt Richard Freeman in particular, who's been referred to the GMC, the General Medical Council. There were things where the attention to detail was very, very sadly lacking. But there are other things that Team Sky and British Cycling did that nobody else did. I mean, before Team Sky, teams did not have in-house coaches. Riders tended to work with their own coaches. You know, lots has been made of the warming up and warming down before races. It sounds like a trivial detail, but they all do that now. The details about mattresses and so on, the way that training was structured on training camps, completely different to what any other team had done in the past. And a lot of these teams have adopted a lot of what Team Sky are doing. What it's done as well what Team Sky have done has really pushed the cost up of sponsoring a team, because It's not just riders' wages, but it's all the support staff that other teams now feel they need to have because Team Sky have them, and it's all the things that Team Sky do. The cost of running a pro team in the Team Sky era, I did a little calculation recently where, you know, team budgets 10 or so years ago, the biggest teams had budgets of about 10 million, 12 million euros. If they'd kept in line with inflation, they'd be about 14, 15 million now. Instead, they're about 30 million, you know, the top teams. So there's been a huge budgetary increase. And, you know, we're looking at a situation now where it's not impossible that Team Sky will disappear. That BMC might disappear. They're the other big spending team. Astana's future seems to be in jeopardy as well. There could be big changes on the horizon in terms of how the sport looks.
Alana, you talked there about the hiring policy of Team Sky and Sean Yates, and here again, you know, one of the key difficulties in picking apart this whole issue and figuring out where you stand on it, where you should stand, is, well, it comes back to a point I made earlier about what was the key audience of Team Sky, and, you know, whether the lion's share of that audience was a new public, and whether it was not people like you and me and Rich who had, you know, been following the sport for a long time. Because, you know, at times it is difficult not to feel quite ambivalent morally about some of this when, as I've spoken about before, your personal hinterland with cycling was a period, you know, when people were taking blood bags three times in a Grand Tour and an EPO and human growth hormone, and then we graduate to sort of 2012, and I could sort of guiltily admit now, you know, if someone had said to me in 2008 that in 2012 a guy would win the Tour de France and the only drugs that he will take would be triamcinolone and he would have a TUE for it, I would think that would be fantastic. That would be what a fantastic outcome for professional cycling, considering, you know, where it was. It was in the depths of sort of moral turpitude at that point, and you know, things did improve a great deal. So, you know, it's quite hard to feel outraged. And by the same token, when Team Sky did hire Sean Yates, Stephen de Jong, and Servais Cannavan, and all of these people about whom there were doubts, you know, they'd been in teams in that era, and there was strong evidence that some of them had doped. Again, the temptation I had at that point was to say, well, you know, the cycling's changed. It doesn't work like that anymore. The director sportif has no impact on, or he has no influence on, what medicine riders are taking. And those guys, even if they took EPO back then, it's not like they're going to be putting syringes in the guy's hands now. However, what I can also envisage, and I can imagine, a scenario whereby in 2012... you know, there are discussions about whether to apply for a TUE, and everyone sort of agrees that, you know, maybe there aren't grounds to do it. But for guys who have come from 1998 or 2004, when, you know, blood bags were flying out of hotel room windows, it doesn't seem like a big deal at all to, you know, be slightly economical maybe with the truth as far as the TUE is concerned. And again, you know, there you see the difference between people who have sort of grown up with the sport and people who haven't. But, you know, Sky did come in wanting to target that market. And maybe the British public was just not grown up and not mature enough for, you know, the kind of difficult things that they were going to have to negotiate and are having to negotiate now as far as professional cycling is concerned. And maybe that is ultimately going to limit the potential of professional cycling and any team whose main market is the British public. I mean, I think the way this story is going now, and if you look at where Chris Froome is in his career and what might happen over the next few weeks, you look where Mark Cavendish is in his career, it kind of feels like a cycle is ending. And, you know, if I was... sort of in charge of a marketing budget of £40 million and in a company based in the United Kingdom, and I was to look at professional cycling now, I would say that no, if you look at the way this story has been covered, people are not yet ready for those nuances, and they're not ready to negotiate that very difficult moral terrain that following cycling ultimately entails and is going to continue to entail. Because medicine and as we spoke about a few weeks ago, and, you know, quite complicated laws and various different authorities involved, that's going to be part of the landscape in professional cycling for a long time.
Another argument is that Team Sky didn't break any rules and that they went right up to the line of what was allowed. And is that not the responsibility of a professional athlete? I'm playing devil's advocate here. I personally, just to add my own personal view, I think that they came along at a time in the sport where we all, including journalists, needed teams to believe in. And the flag bearer was Garmin, who came along in 2008. Now, it's interesting because Garmin are still have that... they still have the people with them. And if you look at what's actually happened at Garmin over the years, you know, from the revelation, which was a revelation to a lot of people, that they had an awful lot of ex-dopers on their team who all contributed to the USADA report, of course. But then other things, like the rider Hesjedal revelation that he also had used EPO previously in his career. We didn't know that when he won the Giro d'Italia in 2012. And then Tom Danielson failed a drugs test for testosterone, a controversial one that. But yeah, any of these episodes, I don't think Team Sky would have survived. And yet, Garmin, you know, not only do Garmin carry on as now Education First, but when they looked like disappearing last year, they launched a crowdfunding campaign that raised a lot of money, which suggests that there's still a lot of goodwill towards them. Now, is that just because they've been more effective at getting their message out there? Is it because they haven't won the Tour de France, because they haven't dominated racing, which is, you know, certainly a factor in, you know, some antipathy towards Team Sky? I don't know, but
Rich, that you make a good point there about the difference between what is now Team EF Education First, previously Garmin, previously Slipstream. Jonathan Vaughters set that team up as an anti-doping team, and his first signing was David Miller, who had come back from a 2-year doping ban. I mean, when you think of the kind of the sort of mental contortions that required to kind of get that message across effectively, it's quite remarkable. But he did that by basically saying that the world is less black and white than perhaps we would all like it to be. What he was very black and white about was, I am not going to tolerate doping. Doping is not going to be part of the program here. But he was going for a kind of second chance ethos, wasn't he? He was going to, his whole thing from the start was, if you tell me privately what you've done in the past, and if you are open and honest to me, then that does not need to be in the public domain. And so the implication was that anyone signing for Garmin may well have doped in the past. And obviously the big one that came out was rider Hesjedal, because what Jonathan Vaughters and co didn't do when Hesjedal won the Giro in 2012, remember, only a month before Wiggins won the Tour, you know, so these are quite sort of relevant examples to compare. But what they didn't do was say, oh, by the way, Hesjedal has confessed to us that when he was racing for teams previously, he doped. Because that would have tarnished and affected the way that people assessed the Giro win, of course. And it subsequently came out. And they kind of got away with it, really, because Vaughters has always managed to have a sort of macro message and a micro message. And he has acknowledged inconsistency and difficult decisions, and he's acknowledged that there are sometimes conflicts between what people say and what they do. And I think the error, if you like, of Dave Brailsford and Team Sky was that, for whatever reason, and I suspect partly coming down from the sort of corporate level, Sky itself, you know, Sky, how could they pump in tens of millions with all of the caveats in brackets below the big you know, the big eye-catching PR claim? They couldn't have done. And so they were, I mean, it's a cliched phrase, but they were kind of hoist by their own petard, really, because they had to say something. And probably, if just to refer back to my blog that's on my website, lionelburney.com, Richard, an interview that an interview that Brailsford and I endured in 2009. It's a section of it specifically relating to Team Sky and their founding principle, this no association with doping line. And it's, you know, it's uncomfortable at times. And and if you read it in black and white, you might get the impression and think, well, why is Brailsford being so incredibly defensive here? And I think in the cold light of day now, many years later, the conclusion I've drawn is that I was effectively, tarnishing his shiny new toy before he'd even got it out of the box by asking him about the whether he had gone back through the past of every single person that he was hiring to see whether they could stand up to the team's founding principle. And I suspect that he realised, having looked at professional cycling from afar, that he couldn't make the team match the message. Now, that doesn't then mean that what he was actually doing was preparing to put in place a comprehensive and cynical and team-wide doping program. I just don't see the evidence for that. What I do see, and you've talked about this a lot, Richard, I do see a sort of a process of compromise that really happened at the end of their first unsuccessful season in 2010, and that led them into these grey areas, sailing very close to the wind in terms of what is legal and what isn't. And I think back to the conversation I had with Brailsford at the final day of the 2011 Dauphiné, the very day that the package in the jiffy bag arrived in Simon Cope's luggage at La Toussuire. In the morning, Brailsford just kind of volunteered out of nowhere a comment about the UCI's new no-needles policy, which had only just been introduced maybe a month before, saying what a fantastic idea it was, because cutting out needles means cutting out the window of opportunity. It means drawing a line between legal recovery products and then banned substances, which, very easy to cross if a rider is used to just having vitamins and nutrients, and then suddenly, well, what's in the syringe? Oh, it doesn't matter. It's going to make me feel better. It's going to make me go faster. So on the one hand, while he's advocating the no needles policy and saying what a great thing it is, the team had put in motion the wheels to enable Bradley Wiggins to legally take triamcinolone, Bradley Wiggins basically has said that the term powerful corticosteroid is a kind of pejorative term, but again, depending on who you listen to, whether it's David Miller or some doctors who say, well, there are alternative treatments that you should try before you hit the big one. It was clear that Brailsford wanted to eliminate some nefarious practices, but was quite happy to operate in the grey areas himself. And I think that's, in the fallout of it all, the sort of the juxtaposition of all these events is quite remarkable in hindsight to look back and realise exactly what was going on at that time.
Chaps, we better wrap this up. I think we'll be talking about this a lot this week, and perhaps even recording some of those thoughts and putting them out as a friend special. We shall see. It's interesting though, Lionel, we spoke about how we were going to cover everything that's happened in cycling this week, because we did witness this hashtag epic race at the weekend, Strada Bianchi, and then obviously the Team Sky story is enormous, and we spoke about whether to divide into two podcasts, do one on the racing, one on the scandal, and we decided not to, because they are kind of different sides of the same coin in a lot of ways. We watched that race, Strada Bianchi, and what we loved about it was that it was so hard and it was brutal, and we saw Wout van Aert literally reach the very limits of his ability. And you cannot have a sport where that is the raison d'etre, and that's kind of what we watch it for, without having issues around doping and medicine and grey areas about recovery and so on. It's just two sides of the same coin, isn't it, really? Before we do wrap things up though, I just want to ask both of you, where does it go now with Team Sky? What happens next? The report's out, the story rumbles on. There's a story in the Times today about Bradley Wiggins' tax affairs. There is a sense, I think, that Wiggins and Dave Brailsford are both still to be toppled, as it were, and within the mainstream press there seems to be quite an appetite to dig up dirt perhaps unrelated to sport and doping allegations in a bid to topple these guys, and especially Brailsford. There are calls for him to resign. There have been for quite a while. Will he survive? What will happen next with Team Sky?
Shall I go first?
Go for it.
Well, I think the key, the kernel of the matter of the allegations is still one thing, and that's whether this TUE was justified or not. It still baffles me slightly that there wasn't a press conference called at the first
available or the first suitable opportunity whereby Richard Freeman, Shane Sutton, Dave Brailsford and Bradley Wiggins sat, and possibly the specialist who gave him the prescription in the first place, didn't face down the questions and didn't explain exactly, you know, what the symptoms were, how bad the symptoms were, and, you know, explain to the best of their ability why this was justified. If they could explain that, then you know, the sort of the guts of this scandal would go away, really, because, you know, the jiffy bag strand to it is still doesn't seem to be leading anywhere at the moment. There are other allegations that seem very difficult to prove, and you know, they're anonymous allegations in this report. And the fact that the whole sort of, well, the class of 2012 as it was seems to have sort of fallen apart, and they seem to be, there almost seems to be some score settling going on, and Bradley Wiggins is certainly not seeing from the same hymn sheet as Team Sky. I think that's sad. It's terrible from Sky's point of view, and I also wonder whether it's not a reflection on how the team was run at the time, and whether perhaps there wasn't the kind of camaraderie and comradeship that we see in other teams. I mean, this is something we felt at the time, that there wasn't a lot of joie de vivre. I remember watching Wiggins warm down after the time trial that he won on the penultimate day in 2012, or 2 days from the end. And I remember I've commented on it in the podcast before, the atmosphere was not the atmosphere you'd expect for a team who was about to win the Tour de France. And you know, maybe they're paying for that slightly now. Maybe, you know, that they don't have that sort of sense of solidarity and that sense of, look, we got into this together, we'll get out of it together. But from my point of view, if they could address that question, then maybe there is a future for the team, and maybe even for Dave Brailsford. Another thing they really need to address, and they should have addressed a long time ago, when did you guys have that, do the interview with Dave Brailsford, the long interview, following another, I can't remember at what
September
stage of the scandal it was.
September
2016, October. When we put the question to Dave Brailsford about the MPCC, and why was that important? It would have been important because it would have gone a long way towards debunking the idea that they'd been using cortisone in training to prepare for grand tours. I felt he fudged the answer to that question. Still nothing has been done. They've neither joined the MPCC, nor have they been able to or taken the initiative to at least try to publish their riders' cortisol levels, which again would probably tell us that they weren't systematically using cortisone in training.
Yeah, this is the MPCC, the Movement for Credible Cycling, which is a collection of teams who have given themselves tougher rules to abide by than the wider code allows. One of those is directly relating to the use of corticoids, cortisone. Yes, Team Sky, well, it's fairly obvious now really why Team Sky, one of the reasons they perhaps didn't join up was possibly because of the restrictions on cortisone use out of competition. It's a, you know, that's a, obviously speculation, but it's an obvious conclusion to draw. I mean, in terms of what happens next, Rich, I really don't know. I mean, we can.
What about your cat? What does your cat think?
Well, the cat has chimed up a bit. I'm not sure. Not showing a lot of interest in.
Maybe we get a clearer opinion from the cat.
Yeah, bored of it now. Just look, it doesn't really like Paris-Nice, I don't think, the cat. Prefers Tirreno. Yeah, see. prefers Tirreno. Quite right, cat. Anyway, I think you know,
is Oscar, I think Oscar Gatto is riding Tirreno.
Favorite rider.
Yeah, his favorite rider is Oscar Gatto. I mean Bradley Wiggins' reputation and his tour win is at best absolutely tarnished. I mean, in the eyes of the public, the front page of the Sun. I mean, we can talk about the sort of the waning influence of you know, national newspapers, but there's, you know, when there's a bad news story, everyone hears about it. I mean, the headline yesterday was you know, was damaging. The general public's view will be, well, Bradley Wiggins took drugs to win the Tour de France, and they will not draw a distinction between what Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins have done and what Lance Armstrong and the US Postal did. They just won't. And you know, whether or not there can be any kind of anti-doping rule violation case is I am really, it's very, very difficult because the select committee has not managed to really prove one way or the other, and I suspect if they could have done, they would have done. So it's not as straightforward as we might think. My personal opinion might well be, well, which it is, that I don't think they should have done it. I don't think that a rider who requires a substance like triamcinolone, from everything I've read and heard about it, and you know, people that I've talked to about it, you know, there are a lighter treatments available that. But you know, on the eve of the Tour de France, you know, Bradley Wiggins is making the point that you know, he's entitled within the rules to treat his asthma, and so we go round and round in circles depending on what you already think about Bradley Wiggins and Team Sky. Really, people's opinions are formulated mostly by that rather than by the evidence. In terms of Dave Brailsford and Team Sky, people saying, well, Dave Brailsford surely must resign after this. Well, I don't think they've been looking at the last 2-3 years. I mean, I don't think there's any chance that Dave Brailsford would resign. My query is, why isn't the question, why aren't Sky sacking him? And, you know, Team Sky currently, and Sky itself, is backing him. You know, there's all this talk about, well, the takeover of Sky and you know, will Comcast own it, or will Disney own it, or will, you know, 21st Century Fox own it? What's going to happen to Sky, the company? I'm not even sure that that has much of a bearing on things either. I think Dave Brailsford, like everything else, will sail on and sort of convince himself that it's not really a problem. But I think that when all is said and done, it is a problem, because it undermines people's confidence in the team. If there's a positive to come out of it, I think that the UCI, WADA, sorry, just for the wait for the cat there. If there's a positive to come out of it, I think the UCI, WADA, and people who run anti-doping in sport may well be moved to look at some of these loopholes, grey areas, call them what you will, and you know, really, really lay down some stronger guidelines and make it much harder for anyone to suspect that a TUE is being used to gain a competitive advantage.
Yeah, we should say that the select committee, one of the recommendations in their report is that WADA should ban corticosteroids and the painkiller Tramadol,
the UCI, Rich, have also released a statement last night saying that they are lobbying WADA to ban those two things.
Who's that? Sorry, Daniel?
The UCI,
UK Anti-Doping as well. Nicole Sapstead was on the radio today saying that they have been, for a few years, been lobbying to ban corticosteroids and Tramadol. That would seem to be a very sensible move. The MPCC have that rule in place. And I think both of you are absolutely right that the failure of Team Sky to join the MPCC is something that we look at now with great cynicism, because none of the answers or explanations given for that really stack up. And, you know, we talk about PR. Joining the MPCC can be PR, but it can also be more than that. Several teams have left having had riders eliminated or ejected from races for having low cortisol levels. But I think the MPCC is trying to do the right thing, and Team Sky could have been a real player in that movement, and it's a great pity they never did join the MPCC. Should we wrap things up there?
Rich, can I add one last footnote to something Napalm said, just about the probability of a UCI investigation? I think that's highly unlikely, not least because the UCI's cock-up is at the very centre of this, i.e., you know, if they think a TUE shouldn't have been granted, they shouldn't have given it to, they shouldn't have approved it. And so they would effectively be investigating themselves.
Yeah. Okay, let's wrap things up. We will return to this, of course, but we have got our shows to look forward to: Nottingham, London, Sheffield and Leeds, and hope to see as many of you there as possible. Looking forward to that immensely. In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Buy our exclusive clothing line made by Rafa at rafa.cc or by clicking on shop at thecyclingpodcast.com. This episode was edited and produced by Alex Adie.